Yes, folks, once again, it's time for another edition of Valley Edition. And it's my great pleasure to welcome everyone into the studio here on this beautiful, beautiful sunny day. I'm going to start with Terry Snyder. You arrived first. Welcome, Terry.
Glad the band's back.
Okay.
Nice to see everybody in person.
And Zaz, we've coaxed you out of wherever you are usually and into the sun and now into the darkness of the studio.
Yes,
welcome,
that's
Zaz.
Right. It's great to be here in person.
And Mark, you're here as well.
Always good to be here.
Yes. This is, okay, we have so many pieces of somewhat unfinished business out there. And I wanted to start with one that involves an ongoing trial, which mm-hmm. may come to conclusion as we're taping this today on Friday. Wow. And that's the Sakai Fire trial. I know that it began, it seems, weeks ago, which was, I think, true. Yep. And the prosecution and defense had their go at it, brought in contending experts who had different things to say. And I just said, okay, let me just, as I was reviewing this, I put in Sakai Fire just to see what would pop up. And, of course, one of the entries is Wikipedia. So we have talked about a variety of different news sources. Well, there is a section in the Wikipedia reference. There's a Wikipedia entry for the Sakai Fire and has a subsection called Cause. And basically, it reminds us that in July of 2015, it was reported by multiple news sources in Alaska that Greg Imick and Amy Dewitt of Anchorage faced numerous charges in relation to the Sakai Fire. That's pretty good. And it lists what they were. And it goes on to say they reportedly ignited several burn piles and failed to ensure that they were properly extinguished before retiring for the evening. And the important, I think, word there is reportedly. And that is true, too. And basically it says a couple later admitted to investigators that they then quickly fled the cabin, leaving behind numerous items out in the open after calling 911. Although she reportedly did not offer any identifying details to the operator when she called. So that was kind of the setup. That's confirmed, if you can call it that, by Wikipedia. Saz, you've watched this. The question here has to do with, was there a sense from the beginning by the public at large that this couple was responsible for the fire? And then how does that play when you go into the courtroom where you have to deal with the details?
Yeah, I think you're right, Mike. I don't know that Wikipedia is it's certainly in hindsight is the go-to source on this, although I'm sure some of the references are from my newspaper and from some of my stories. I think that before Greg Imick and Amy DeWitt were charged, there was the initial theory that fireworks caused the fire, mm-hmm. right? Because right. neighbors heard them setting off fireworks. They mm-hmm. told investigators, setting off fireworks that weekend. Mm-hmm. And that, as you know, if you read our paper, hasn't been allowed to come up. The word fireworks is the F word in this trial. No one is allowed to mention fireworks because in an earlier hearing before the trial started, it was deemed that fireworks would be prejudicial to the jury. Mentioning fireworks would be prejudicial to the jury against Imick and DeWitt. And the prosecution wanted to argue that the fact they were shooting off fireworks when it was as dry and windy as it was went to their recklessness, which is one of the charges against them. And sort of the criminality underpinning what they did was that they didn't, not only did they not use common sense, but they were reckless in what they did in starting the Sakai Fire, or one of the charges against them. And Judge Zwink ruled that that was inadmissible in court. And so what that led to was audio tapes that were bleeped out when the word fireworks came up, which, as I understand, made it sort of hard to understand what the people were saying. Photos shown on the big screen in the courtroom that had these, you know, black spots, like on a dirty picture or a picture of a dog that shows too much. These black squares covering fireworks as evidence. And I'm sure some of the jurors figured it out. It was probably kind of confusing.
Who wanted that word?
The defense wanted any reference to fireworks struck.
Which seems like a kind of a, I mean, I I'm sure those of us have been here a long time know about the Big Lake Fire.
And that was the rationale.
And that was rationale. Yes. But I'm not even sure, was that ever proven?
No.
That was never proven.
No.
It was fireworks. So that seems very odd.
Yeah. And so that, if there is a not guilty verdict from the jury, the jury, today's Friday morning, they are deliberating now and could reach a verdict today. It's
right.
Entirely possible. If they do find a not guilty, at least on the sort of more serious charges, I have a feeling that the prosecution is, I don't know if they'll appeal, but they certainly will be grumbling about that fireworks omission.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, so the as I understand it, the underpinnings of this trial have been that the state has laid out a case based on the forestry fire investigators involved, and the defense has picked away at the credibility of the investigation, even going so far as to say Greg Emig and Amy DeWitt weren't responsible for this fire.
Have they picked away at it in a compelling way?
I haven't seen any of the defense testimony and most of the cross-examination, but as I understand it, they have.
Mm-hmm. Any sense of how the verdict is going to go?
I'm not putting any money on it either way. Well, no, at least Kevin, by Monday, I'll probably know.
Yeah, Kevin Fitzgerald from Anchorage is a very capable attorney.
Yes.
I know that.
And Shanahan is capable as well.
Yeah.
As is Eric Senta. Mm-hmm. He's worked hard in this case, even though he's not in the Palmer District Attorney's Office anymore. He's a white-collar crime guy now in Anchorage.
Right. Did they present any witnesses at all for the defense? I guess I haven't followed it closely.
Amy testified.
Okay,
Amy, I don't know
her.
If she's Emig now. They are married. But Amy DeWitt testified, and Susanna Caldwell, who's covering it for the paper, said her testimony was pretty compelling. She got emotional, but only when she talked about her son facing, with the fire behind him, coming up behind him, which was interesting. I understand that one of the defense attorneys then later made a contradictory point that nobody was ever threatened by this fire, which isn't true.
Oh, yeah. So there would be a lot of firefighters that would testify other than that,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah.
So also it's important, I think, to remember that all of these accusations covered in the trial are misdemeanors. And they're subject to something on the order of $10,000 and a year in jail. This does not preclude further
civil actions.
Civil
yes.
actions, et cetera.
Yeah,
they'll
definitely
would go
be civil
on.
Actions.
So we'll do that. Okay, so that's received a lot of attention. Much less in the way of a lot of fire. There was a spark in or two that involved two of the legislators that represent people from the Valley. And I'm talking about, of course, Senator Wilson and then also Representative Eastman. And Representative Eastman was recently censured by the House in a rather, I would say definite majority way.
Bipartisan.
Yeah, bipartisan, not only the coalition, but some additional members
of
his own party,
three others
joined
party.
In to do that. And my understanding is that this does not happen. There was a member of the legislature, Jacko, for other purposes, ethics violations involving other things, but that was way back 20 years ago. So this is not the kind of thing that the bodies, either the Senate or the House, do on a regular basis. And there was some response from, as I understand, Mr. Eastman, but there was some grumbling also that his apology did not seem very fervent. Any comments, Mark?
Yeah, both times that I saw his attempt to apologize, they seemed to come with a clear but. But it's okay because of this, and this. So not what I would call a fully sincere apology. Still, I think, a bit surprising to see the move to censure. And at the same time, for me personally, it came with disappointment. Charisse Millette, for example, was outspoken in the press about it, about the comments, and suggested, I think, that he apologize. And she said she was offended as a Native woman. She ultimately did not vote to censure. So there seemed to be a little bit of party politics involved in the final vote. But the final outcome, I think, was satisfying to most people.
Mm-hmm. Over on the other side, of course, we had Senator Wilson. I have heard much less about the reverberations from the sound of the slap.
Nothing.
Who's going to censure somebody for slapping a reporter?
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, okay. All right. So I'm right. I haven't missed something here. No.
I wondered if I had missed something, too, because it seems to me to be begging for more attention.
Well, it may be getting more attention that hasn't shown up in the paper.
Well, and also there was a police report filed, so I don't know that there was any charges levied, but there was.
There were not charges filed.
I thought they couldn't charge during session.
Oh, maybe.
Oh, I was thinking of something else.
It might have been a report filed, but charges would not be forthcoming until perhaps when the session ends.
And certainly being in session should not preclude at least an apology or an admission of guilt or, you know, yeah, I overstepped or something. And I haven't heard anything.
You know, I think that's what's the most disappointing part of all of this is even when Eastman did offer some sense of apology, it was if his words, not for his words, not what he said, but if it hurt somebody's
right.
feelings. And that's what, to me, people say, I know I say things all the time I regret. Everybody says something that they regret. But for them to just, you know, double down, and you've seen this over and over with legislators, that they just double down on the hurt, basically, by not just owning it and saying, I did it, and I shouldn't have said that. It's really, really, really rare in this day and age to have someone, and they're under enormous scrutiny, and I appreciate that about them. But you would think at this day and age with everybody watching, if somebody did do that, they'd own it. And they would say heartfully that I think about Lynn Gaddis and her misstatements concerning seniors last year. She never owned it. She just said she said I was misquoted, and then it was proven that she was not misquoted. Then she tried to make excuses for it, but not once did she stop and say, I was wrong. I totally misspoke. In my heart, I do not believe that, and I apologize to all seniors. She didn't say that. So, you know, I would think.
And she might be senator if she had.
Yeah, could be. And, you know, she may want to be senator when David Wilson comes back around again in another 3 years. But I think if there's any takeaway, if I was a legislator, I think I would be thinking about that as I proceed, because that is not an expectation the public should not have of their elected officials.
What do the two or three of you think is Eastman, what is his motive here? I mean, was this a conscious effort to pander to a certain base? Was it a misstatement that now he doesn't want to back away from? Where is he coming from?
Well, I don't, it's hard to say because been still pretty outspoken on his own Facebook pages and other pages. So I just think he thinks everybody else is wrong about his observations. And he is pandering to he is getting some feedback. To be fair, he is getting some feedback from some people who think there was absolutely nothing wrong with what he said, and that we're too over politically it's too, you know, everybody has to politically conform with what they speak. So
yeah, comments along the lines of good for you for telling it like it is, that kind of thing, not being afraid to tell the truth.
Right. So I think he is getting some of that feedback, but it's hard to say what goes on. He's a freshman legislator. He is inexperienced. Some of it could be chalked up to inexperience, but yet there's lots of inexperienced legislators down there, and none of them have made these misstatements. So.
Is it possible that what you're witnessing locally is something that has played out, it is said, on the national stage, which is not understanding that comments made...
Words matter.
Yeah. Well, comments made, if you're sitting around a table somewhere and something pops into your head and you say it, is one thing. But then you go into a position of some responsibility, and the responsibility extends to what you say. That if you make an offhand comment, it's difficult to walk that back. It may be just by virtue of the personality of the person speaking, difficult to walk things back. But until someone gets either the experience or actually believes that thinking before you speak is important, a comment made, repeating of something that you had heard or read, whether it's in some form of a blog or a place, or someone has said that, and you say that, giving it the authority that's equal to something that has been researched, thought about, put together as a true statement of where you are. I almost believe that it's not necessarily a pandering effort, but simply being not able to distinguish between comments and thoughtful statements.
Well, or the whole fake news phenomenon, where we get so much information flowing at us from so many different sources, some credible, some not. You know, I heard this. I mean, the president was making what appeared to be factual statements based on something a guy told him during a golf game. And the guy later said, "I never said any such thing."
You know? Right. So we hear what we want to hear sometimes.
But he never takes response. I think the point that I get out of what Mike said is that we have somebody who's leading our country right now that is not taking responsibility for any time he misspeaks. And so is that the new, that's the new bar? Is that the new acceptable level? I was thinking about that, watching all these graduations this year, and just thinking about, is that really the parents that do support him and have sort of poo-pooed anybody calling him on the carpet for things that he's misspoken about? Is that really the message you want to give your kids, that that's the way you go through life, is to say things that aren't true and to not take responsibility when you say the wrong thing? Because if that's the case, we are in for, you know, a big problem down the road here with our youth. It worries me.
Okay, well, let us bring this whole subject set that we're covering down to a local area. This week there was one maybe before we do that, let's finish up with the legislature, because just today I saw the report of a very interesting suggested transfer by the Senate, the Alaska Senate, to move $50 million and to help with filling some of the gap that was going to be caused by budget reductions in other places. And the source of the money was, of course, the big deal. It was $50 million out of a fund that has been set aside to be used to promote a gas line. Any of you have any thoughts about that at all? Mark?
Yeah, mixed thoughts. It certainly, I think, there should be broad support for funding those things. Taking it out of the gas line struck me immediately as being, a political move, a poke in the eye to the governor by someone who's very likely to be running against him in 2 years. That, of course, we'll see for sure down the line. But it should, as a policy move for now, I expect it will be widely supported.
Mm-hmm. Well, except that, you know, I guess the devil's in the details. And once again, education is being held hostage because they're not letting the amount that they've said out of that $50 million that can go to education. Not quite giving it to them, just going to set it aside.
Right.
So you might get some buy-in, but I think they'll have to loosen that up before you'll get buy-in from the House on that, because that's just another hostage taker. They could walk that back next session and just say, we changed our minds. So
good points.
Because you can't really designate, I don't think. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you can, but I think that was pretty predictable that they took care of the Pioneer Homes. There's been a lot of screaming. There's a lot of voters that would be very unhappy to have the session end on that sour note. And also, you know, taking care of seniors, which, of course, I think that's one of the fundamental reasons.
It was Senator Dunleavy that proposed this, and it passed unanimously, and it's going to be taken over to the House. And the House has responded by saying, we're going to look at the details here. They wanted to see what impact this would have on further work with the gas line, among other things, and probably the details of how the money is being divvied up. But you brought up the question, because I saw the reference there to the monies for the Pioneer Home, and it wasn't clear to me that what seemed to be clear to me was that the Senate was still asking the Department of Health and Human Services to spread the pain around so that monies that happened to equal the funding for the Pioneer Home would not be taken out. But it sort of saw that as a little flare up of a continuing question about funding. Terry?
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen it particularly. I haven't looked at it. But, you know, funding them, the question is, are they funding them to where they are now, or are they going to allow them to open some beds that are now sitting empty because they haven't had funding for a couple of years? So I would have to see specifics on that. I mean, I think most people have said, but then most people have said a lot about a lot of things they haven't listened to this session, that they want those beds open and utilized because there's thousands of people waiting in line to be in them, and it's really our only resource for long-term care up here. So,
looking ahead, Wednesday is the end time where if the legislature finishes, they'll finish on Wednesday. If they don't, they would presumably go for another 10-day extended session, which is within the guidelines and rules that they operate under.
That seems likely to me.
That seems to be likely around.
I don't know about 10 days, but at least 3 or 4, depending on what they want to finish up.
Okay. Well, coming back then finally to the local area, Tuesday there was a meeting at the City of Palmer, and probably the, in some respects, the most significant event was the passage of a proposal, an ordinance change in the previous meeting to involve the city council in any of the decisions in the city of Palmer where a PUD was being considered, so that the final decision or the process wouldn't be one that would be taken care of somewhat administratively at the PNC, but would actually come to the council for action. Because there had been criticism that some of these actions that the PNC were taking did not have sufficient review. They were contentious enough to require that. So that approval came even with the absence of two council members because it had been discussed in the previous meeting, went on. The planning director, Sandra Garley, in a later interview that I was able to have with her, confirmed that two things. One, what I have said is accurate, which I like. And secondly, the status of the property that's right near the Palmer Junior Middle School, and actually probably ignited this entire controversy. A question of, was that going to be too intensive development? Was it a development that and had a variety of low-income people that would be living in it? It was too intense, too dense, et cetera. Well, what she has pointed out is that there is a continuing legal action, which has not been scheduled yet by the parties involved. And the parties are the nearby senior development, as well as the group that, as I remember, that has made the proposal to do the development. Now, what is actually happening, though, in the background is that a second group has come in and has proposed a senior-only development for that area. That's because the owner, the people that made the first recommendation that had set out to do this at first had said, you know, if somebody else wants to do it, we're not going to in any way be able to stand in line. The property owner could sell this to another party. So what we have, as I understand, is a situation where if the senior only developing group is able to negotiate with the property owner, that would be more acceptable, although there may be objections in part as well, to the nearby senior development. And the question about what happens then to the legal action, does that become moot? Probably if an agreement is made between the property owner and a new developer. So we're still awaiting that because, as best I know, that decision has not been made, but if it should be made, then it would probably be fitting right under the guidelines that have recently been changed, and the council would have a role to play in it if it requires a PUD.
So that's a new change totally to code.
Yes, but that's a big change.
The council presiding over PUD decisions.
Yes, yeah, that's a major change.
I would assume they still go to the planning commission.
But yes.
They have to
Recommendations then would go to the council, and the council would act rather than having the PNC make that the decision as they had. Mm-hmm. So it may mean that there won't be legal action. It may mean that you'll see a development begin there that will be more compatible with the neighbors' interests. I'm not sure.
And someone dies.
Once again, we'd have to see what the details are. But a lot of energy, and it reminds that in the city of Palmer, there is little space for big development. There are a couple of large parcels, but not many. And so as time goes on and more of those available spaces get filled, this question of density and intensity, I think, may become...
And certainly outside the cities in the borough, it has been an issue for some time. And as I'm getting phone calls, the high-density housing development is going in between Palmer Fishhook and Wasilla Fishhook, where the Fishhooks come together. I'm not getting calls on that. I think Channel 2 did a story on that. The continued population growth, the need for affordable housing in the valley, the lack of zoning is culminating in a lot of multifamily proposals.
Yeah,
and high density.
Yeah, and plus infrastructure. So I'm not sure. They probably have natural gas out there, but not sure. But no water. So everybody's on sewer and septic. So that is another thing that we have to think about as we grow.
Okay. Well, I think we have come to the end of another edition of Valley Edition. Hard to believe, but time passes when you're having this much fun. I want to thank Terry Snyder for coming in today.
Enjoy the weekend.
And I want to thank Zaz Hollander for also coming out of the sun.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Great to be here. Hopefully the sun will continue.
Yes. And Mark Kelsey, thank you very much for coming in. I understand you're going to be going off on a trip around the country soon.
Heading out as soon as school gets out.
Okay. Well, our best to you on that trip. And I was thinking, what a wonderful thing it would be if, as you travel around the country, you call in with a few reports about what the real world is like.
I can do that.
We'll do that. Okay.
Maybe he wants to dismiss the real world.
Well, thank you all for coming in, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Valley Edition.